The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsigned Methods. I'm Lachlan Bloom and this is part of a series where we talk to fellow authors about their process and technique.
I'm JB Batchin and today marks the 10th episode of Unsigned Methods. Today's episode is with the writer Joanna Cavena, who joined us remotely in the middle of last winter. Joanna is the author of Ice Museum, Inglorious, The Birth of Love, Come to the Edge, and most recently 2016's A Field Guide to Reality.
We had a great conversation with Joanna, ranging from her beginnings in writing through the process of finding a voice for a particular piece of fiction and how that process compares with writing non-fiction, and leading into the need for a more Wittgensteinian view of reality.
Ladies and gents, Joanna Cavena.
If we can maybe start by talking about your sort of route into writing.
Yeah. I suppose I was one of those weird children who always wrote, and that was the main thing I did as a child. I read obsessively, and I tried to convey the weird, complex feelings I had about the world, or childhood complex, into words. And I loved music as well, but part of the attraction of music was trying to write lyrics to the dodgy songs or musicals that I was writing. So it was always really words, and I guess I didn't think I'd be able to have any kind of career as a writer when I was growing up. I didn't know anyone who wrote books or who published things. So that seemed a very remote thing. It seemed I venerated the writers that I loved, and I assumed they were somehow other sorts of mortals. So it really was only when I went to university that I started to think about maybe trying to be an academic or possibly a journalist. But the idea of actually trying to write an entire book and putting that into the world, that was quite a late arrival into that idea for me, I think.
And were there any particular authors that sort of inspired you, or that you venerated as a kid or later on?
I mean, I suppose I went through the whole E. Nesbitt, Susan Cooper, was obsessed with those Darkest Rising kind of books, the Tolkien phase, and then went into reading people like D.H. Lawrence, Virginia Woolf, I guess T.S. Eliot. I think if you read T.S. Eliot, you know, Prufrock, when you're about 15, 16, you feel it absolutely expresses all your angst about the world and the weirdness of existence and reality and so on. And then I studied English at university, so then I had this amazing experience of just reading at will and got very into things like sci-fi and Philip K. Dick and Stanislaw Lem, and then into philosophy, reading, you know, lots of ranging, I suppose, from the Enlightenment philosophers through into the kind of rise of people like Wittgenstein and the kind of collapsing of previous ideas of absolute realities and so on.
And at what point did you first work on a novel sort of from start to finish?
I guess at the end of university, I wrote my first novel. And that was inevitably a pretty chaotic affair. And the major thing, I think, when you first write a novel is perspective and vantage points. Who are you? You know, who is the person relaying the story? If you have multiple consciousnesses. And that's something I always think is really odd. And I've had that process in every novel. There's something fundamentally strange that we all do as writers, which is if you aspire to the kind of modernist stream of consciousness, you ask the reader to inhabit lots of people's minds, to go from one consciousness to another, which is a completely phantasmagoric thing. We don't do that in reality. We can't squat in people's minds and hear their thoughts. And then the other option, of course, is these first person narrators. And that, for me, that was a huge stall on everything I wrote, was the sort of improbability of modernist stream of consciousness and trying to work that out, because I was hugely influenced by the modernists, but somehow when I inhabited that mode, it didn't work. So that's a lot of my early novels collapsed around those questions, and I didn't try to publish them. I wrote a lot in my sort of early 20s that just never quite rightly went to a publisher.
And is it always clear to you the voice or the perspective that the novel's going to where it's going to come from when you first sort of conceive the novel, or is it something that you change quite a few times before you find the right voice? Is the voice kind of the central part of the novel, or is there some other concept that is central and then the voice is something you find later on?
Yes, that's a really, really interesting question. I think I usually start with an array of possible characters and possible scenarios and possible ideas, and they're all really tenuous. And I kind of read around that and sketch around that for really a very long time while doing money earning jobs and other things, of course. And that really takes ages. And you're absolutely right. The question about the voice, in a way, that's the thing that's going to make the novel spark into existence. And if it never gets the voice, then it will just be this unwieldy bundle of possibilities. So you're trying to coax out the voice with all the reading and thinking and arranging things into possible structures. You just really want the voice to ignite, and when it does, you're completely off and it's all fine. And often the voice can be a character. I mean, often I use first person narrators precisely for that reason, because once you get in their head and you've got their mode, then that's a huge impetus. It generates its own impetus actually in the telling of it, because you know them and you know what they're going to feel and say and how they're going to respond. But it's exactly that. And when the voice doesn't come, your entire thing collapses. And also, if you try the voice and it doesn't work, it's really obvious. It just sounds fake, I think.
I was going to ask on that score whether you've spent a significant time in pursuit of a voice that will ignite and not found it, and how you then address that as a strategy, although it might never have come to that point, obviously.
Yeah, and I apologize for my mixed metaphor about the voice and the ignition, but it is that sense of sort of making a fire somehow. I suppose it's so odd, and actually it's the one thing I've really learned about writing, and it's in a way the only experiential element that I can really impart, is that thing of waiting. And it obviously drives the writer mad, because you don't know if it's ever going to emerge, that thing. And it also drives if you have a publisher who's interested or kind enough to care what you're doing, it can slightly drive them mad as well, because there is no finite, tangible aspect to that process. And it's the one really curious thing. And I suspect it applies to lots of idiosyncratic creative enterprises, that because it's just this individual vantage point that you're trying to convey to the world, there's something quite esoteric about the process of managing to discern even that vantage point and then managing to communicate it. It's a very odd process, but it's in all the art and all the writing I really admire, is that sense that someone has really struggled to create their own absolutely distinctive version of reality and has then somehow managed to convey it. Whether you're talking about Duchamp, you know, with his kind of alchemical sculptures, or whether you're talking about someone like Knut Hamsun just managing to write in the 1890s about the crazed experience of trying to create art in an inimical society. It's always intrinsic to those works, I think.
And when you're in that process of the sort of waiting or exploration of different voices, is that a process that you... Do you explore it through writing? Do you take lots of notes, or fill notebooks, fill Word documents, or is it more a case of thinking and mulling things over and until the point where you have the voice, and then it's only at that point you put pen to paper?
Yeah, I do both, actually. I do a lot of reading in a very capricious way. I think I did a doctorate, and I obviously have an experience of doing that much more measured and rigorous kind of reading with a very specific research objective in mind. But when you're writing a novel, you just grasp at tiny fragments of things, or you can read in a very almost self-indulgent way, because you're just drawing elements in or trying to conjure an atmosphere or an array of ideas. So I do that a lot. And I do write only longhand, because I think once you commit it into a document, that's when you're hoping it's just going to really force a path, actually. And there's something about if you do that too early, you start cutting and pasting and you start rearranging bits. And that's usually the death for me of the project, is when it just starts to collapse in on itself. So I've now learned that one discipline, which is I don't permit anything to go on a computer until I'm fairly secure in the whole edifice.
So you would maybe have some notes that you've written about it. But then when you come to actually writing the work itself, you wouldn't refer back to them. You'd just start with a blank page and put the notes to one side.
Yeah, I usually actually have drafted a whole version of it longhand, or maybe even a couple of versions. But then when I start it again, I get rid of all that. Margaret Atwood, actually, I had the luck to interview her recently in the Sheldonian, and someone had been asking about whether she structured her books. And she said, no, because if I knew what would happen in them, I wouldn't want to write them. And there is that element as well, that you want, having done all this preparation, you want the thing to go into the kind of realm of the unknown as well. But you have your voice to kind of draw the reader and even, you know, your own kind of book structure through that world, essentially. So I think that's how it works. But then you never quite know if it's going to work the same way each time.
Do you ever come across a voice that you're really intrigued by and taken with, and you know there's some substance to it, but when you try to take it on a journey, it doesn't take you anywhere that you find satisfying? Are there any voices that you've had to kind of abandon?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, my last novel, which was called A Field Guide to Reality, that began with a character. He's actually now a character in the novel called Anthony York, who's an academic at a parallel version of Oxford University. And initially I wrote in his head, and I actually then wrote an essay for something published by Notting Hill Editions called Alchemy, which was people writing about art, including Ian Sinclair and Gabriel Giuseppevici and Ben Markowitz and Anna Kena Schofield. And he ended up as a character in that essay with his own vantage point perspective. But somehow, whenever I put him in a novel, he fell apart. There was something about him that he had to be. For me, I was so interested in observing him, but I couldn't quite be him, or I couldn't, you know, get the narrative to sort of go via his head. So I needed another narrator to somehow respond to him. And that often happens. It's very odd, because I was really interested in him as a character, but I couldn't quite permeate his consciousness as I had invented it. But it all sounds, it's a crazy process when you start to relay it, but it has this odd personal reality as you write these things. And I think when I read other writers writing about this process, and Margaret Atwood, again, is really brilliant on this, and Jess Butterworth has spoken really interesting about this, there's a kind of strange fear of the whole thing collapsing all the time, because it is somehow quite fragile. But when it does work, it has a sort of odd energy to it, I think.
And when you get to the stage of writing the work, and you have the voice, and you feel that there is substance, that it will sort of extend to a novel, do you tend to then work fairly systematically from beginning to end, or do you write a section and then start somewhere else that the voice sort of takes you, and these pieces slowly sort of start to join up? Does it depend from novel to novel how that process works?
Well, actually, that is the process which is the guilty, absolute, total joy. I mean, that's in a way why you do it, because it's just totally addictive, completely brilliantly wonderful, and you actually can't believe at that point you get to do this at all. It's so glorious, because you've actually got this thing that is urging itself along. And I think that's the process, and that might be why writers return to this, again, very peculiar enterprise. And maybe it's the same if you're an artist or a musician, I don't know, or anything, or if you're a scientist trying to generate a theory, and there's all of this kind of failure, this utter excruciating failure. And that's the other thing, I think, when you do something, even if you do something like writing, you're incredibly bad at it most of the time. And there's this awful personal embarrassment, actually, that you kind of try and, you know, weather, that so many of your attempts are just atrocious, in fact. And then, but yet there's this process where you actually, it seems to sort of have at least some internal coherence, irrespective of what the reader feels when they get to it, which is a whole other thing. And so that is just, it's actually glorious. It's really quite wonderful. And when that works, the writing is very fast, and you just have to almost make sure you can just free everything else up and try to just really go for it.
So it sounds like it's a fairly chronological, but the sort of chapter one is followed by chapter two is followed by chapter three, and in the writing process you sort of go with the flow. And
yeah, at that point, usually at that point you write down, I tend to write down, maybe like in my last novel, it had 12 sections. And so with the final process, and I'd written lots and lots of drafts of it, and I had loads of stuff that I knew might pertain to each section. And I had the characters, and I'd written in the minds of at least one other character, actually two in that book, I think. And so I knew I had all that material, but then I just literally had these 12 titles for sections and then the computer, and then you just sort of type, basically.
How does your drafting process work? Are you looking for specific things as you do like another run through, or is it just tightening up and you're holding all of the strands together in your mind at the same time?
What you're really looking for, and again, this is, there's a completely personal judgment of it. You're looking for the kind of authenticity of voice, the voice that convinces you, that you hope will then communicate meaningfully to the reader. That's really what you're looking for. And you only have your own internal system of assessment. So there's no objective judge of that. It's just the kind of predilections of the author and their taste. And that's why, you know, I think, and I agree with Virginia Woolf on this, that there's no absolute good or bad novel. And she says about, you know, she says that the same novel is called by both names, depending on which critic you go to. And she says, all you can really do is write the novel you want to write. And then at least that has an integrity of purpose, because whatever happens to it, you have at least committed to that process. And as Lawrence Durrell said, then each novel is sui generis because it is itself. There is no such thing really as the novel. There's just a lot of weird novels.
You know, what happens if you get into a sort of dead end? You're in the flow of writing, you're with the character, and at some point you feel this is not going where I want it to go. Do you then sort of just move on and keep on writing, or do you go back and sort of redraft that chapter as you're going, sort of thing? Is the redrafting process something that happens only once you've got to the end of a complete first draft, or if you feel something's wrong, would you go and redraft it the following day, having slept on it?
No, I try not to do. Well, so I would do that actually in the early drafts and the handwritten drafts. I do quite a lot of that. I would write something, chuck it away, try it again. I start again a lot. And I mean, even actually, if that computer version goes really badly and starts to sort of flake out, I would then drop it. And I've even done that actually quite late in the process, where it seemed like it was going really well. And I was able to say to the publisher, yes, it's finally coming through, it's all okay. And then actually something just started to collapse with it, and the whole thing has to then go actually. And then you have to re-begin. And there's a poor publisher kind of in a state of mild shock, you know, because it's almost like a sort of taking off in an aeroplane. You know, there's a point where the thing's going to go up anyway because of basic laws of, you know, aerodynamics. But there are lots of things that could go wrong even as you're quite far down the runway, I suppose.
And would you restart writing in longhand? Is that particularly connected to that part of the creativity?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this differs enormously from one writer to another. And I suppose it partly depends what distinction writing, you know, either longhand or on a computer makes to your thought processes and to your work. And I just find that when you write longhand, you enter into much more of a kind of fluent process of writing, because you don't, as you mentioned, go back and start revising things. And so you just carry on. And I do think probably books that are written I'm very interested in that whole thing of, for example, Henry James, got terrible RSI and stopped writing his own books and started dictating them. And the question of how that would change the process, I think this is a really interesting aspect of writing, is the sense that you can do it in different ways that radically alter the way the words will sound on a page.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying the show. If you have a moment, please do rate the podcast wherever you download. And if you have any feedback or comments, we'd love to hear from you at info@unsignedmethods.co.uk.
I know you've mixed nonfiction and fiction, and I wanted to ask a little bit about how those two different forms of writing, how you approach them, if there's any difference in your head between writing fiction and nonfiction.
I think only at the level, I mean, at the level of the research, there's a huge difference in that the Ice Museum, as you mentioned, that was the first book I wrote, and it was a book about a myth of the last land in the north, the furthest land that an ancient Greek explorer called Pythias felt he'd got to 6 days' sail beyond the British Isles. And it was called Thule, Thule. And he was then not believed by ensuing classical writers, including Strabo. And it became a sort of myth that was attached to an idea of remoteness and the places beyond the maps and the unknown. And it was moved further and further north from the Shetland Isles to Iceland. And even now in Greenland, there's a Thule air base, an American Cold War air base, and a Thule village. And so my book was a kind of look both at the possible places this myth had been attached to and might have been attached to, but also why people are attracted to ideas of the unknown. Why we have this sense almost of hubris about discovering everything and trying to unfurl ancient mysteries and so on. And so that had a huge, really specific research aspect to it, because I had to look at primary sources in Norwegian and German, and I had to learn both languages, go and spend a long time in libraries and at institutions in both Germany and Norway doing research into the various kind of writings on this story, and also spent a lot of time in countries like Estonia, again trying to interview people because Estonia was one of the possible Thules, and travel to all the various places, Scotland, Norway, Iceland, Greenland, and so on. So it was a big research endeavour that was helped a lot by, I worked at universities, the University of Oslo and Ludwig Maximilian's University in Munich, to kind of keep money going and to obviously learn the languages and understand a bit about those cultures as well. And so it was a really huge project that lasted many years. But again, actually, the writing of it was it very much as we've discussed. I wrote a lot of drafts of it, and then there was a final moment when, because it was a first-person travelogue, that's the way I'd in the end tried to do it. And I was very influenced by people like W.G. Sebald and Ian Sinclair and Jeff Dyer. Then it had to have that impetus again and that point where actually the persona that I'd created took over the story and conveyed it to the reader.
Mm. Presumably there were elements that you were submitting with as academic work along the way as well, then that formed part of the research. It was as well as the longhand notes that you'd written out, there were other artifacts that
huge amounts. I mean, and I did lots of interviews with explorers and travelers and people who had done their own research into this myth, including the first post-independence president of Estonia, Leonard Meri, who was an extraordinary man who had his own theory of Thule. And I went to see people like Roland Huntford, who was an expert on Fridtjof Nansen, is an expert, and asked him about, because Nansen, this great Norwegian explorer, had bound this myth into all his Arctic explorations. And so asked Huntford about his thoughts. And so there was a lot of that. And then going up to places like Svalbard, the Norwegian Arctic archipelago, and trying to talk to climate scientists up there about the melting of the ice and almost the kind of pollution of these formerly incredibly remote, untouched realms. So there was a lot of that aspect, yeah, quite academic research and talking to people, yes.
I was just going to ask, this is a very tangential question really. So I just think in terms of doing research for a piece of writing, learning two languages is going some, but I assume, did you also have polar bear training when you went to Svalbard?
I did have, insofar as I was advised that if I saw a polar bear, I should either run or become an expert in shooting a firearm. So I tended to aim for the running option. And most of the time I tried to be with someone who was able to use the firearm. But yes, I mean, there is, of course, this incredibly sobering, tragic aspect of any form of Arctic expedition, which is that the Arctic, as this enormous remote region, became a kind of great white hiding place for nuclear pollutants and environmental pollutants, and obviously the kind of theory that human-made global warming is now melting the ice is, you know, extremely current in Arctic research. And so the polar bears were much more present than they had been because they were hungry and they were coming further into the communities on Svalbard. Yes, so that was a very you know, tragic aspect of enormous changes in the environment that have become even more apparent since I was researching that book.
Going back to the idea of Thule as the unknown, the sort of the beyond, I guess a lot of nonfiction, a view of nonfiction is that it is sort of chipping away at the unknown as sort of academic research as well. It's the unknown, and through producing more nonfiction, we can understand more of it and slowly diminish the unknown.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily apply to fiction. I don't know if you have any thoughts on what fiction is adding to the world in a way. If nonfiction is sort of chipping away at the unknown, what does fiction do for you?
Yes. Well, fiction, I think all writing deals with this, but in fiction you have a very free rein with it. There are these two fundamental mysteries that we deal with. One is reality. We don't understand reality in a kind of complete objective way. And the other one is consciousness and mind. We don't really understand the mind of the individual who is apprehending this bizarre reality. So we have these two enormous areas of indeterminacy, and you'd need to be omniscient to get absolute categorical answers to either of those questions. And I think they're incredibly fascinating. And to me, they're the great debates of the time that we're living in as we go into these realms of AI and, you know, the sort of deep mind technologies and these attempts to recreate human consciousness, you know, in the digital world. We're in this really fascinating revolutionary moment, and yet we still don't have, and in a sense, it is impossible to imagine that we might have absolute eternal theories either of the reality beyond or the reality within. And so I think the novel, because you have, it's almost like a kind of history of minds, you know, as people have gone through eras of history and their own finite experience of consciousness, they have somehow conveyed some aspect of this bizarre encounter that they've had with the world, the stuff around. And so to me, that's why I love reading. And that's why I really want the books I read to have this sense of the kind of as authentic as possible, a rendering of that peculiar encounter of the individual in the world. That's what I'm really searching for, that sense that someone's being really honest in trying to convey, despite all the limits of language, which is another kind of weird mystery that we work with, trying to convey how it felt to be alive at that time and what they saw. So I think that's what fiction does, and that's why I love fiction and why I think fiction's really, even in a highly materialist, scientific, empirical world, as we ostensibly are at the moment, these kind of encounters of mortals with reality are so important.
And from that, is there anything you would say makes bad fiction? I mean, there's obviously a range of different conscious experiences of the world, and as you referenced Virginia Woolf, a good novel may be called a bad novel by somebody else. But is there anything just generally bad fiction that is extending that desire to explore the conscious lived experience?
Yeah, I suppose, again, this is really my own personal predilection, and that's all we have really when we're looking at these modes. I would say, and again, I like this Albert Camus idea that when we talk to people, we sort of know whether they're lying, or we think we know. We have some sense when people aren't being honest with us, and we don't really like it, and we don't know. We assume there's some motive beneath it that isn't necessarily a particularly glorious motive. And I think it's a bit like that. You spend a long time with an author when you read their work, and so you develop a sense of whether you believe that they're being honest with you or whether they're lying, and whether that's an utter fantasy or not. And it may just be they're not your sort of person. But I think it's more like that for me. It's that thing of finding, a bit like when you're seeking someone with whom you want to have a conversation, there will be reasons why you might gravitate towards someone. And it might be that sense they're being honest, or it might be just they say things that you find fascinating or scintillating. But for me, those are the judgment points for fiction, and they're extremely subjective. And that's why I recoil from objective manifestos on art or quasi-objective or objective notions that we can have, you know, canonical classical fiction versus non-canonical fiction. I think those are all extremely arbitrary.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Unsound Methods. We hope you're enjoying the show. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods or view our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk. So I guess sort of related to the previous question about bad fiction things, I just wanted to ask your opinion on a question that's as old as the novel, I guess, which is about the oft foretold death of the novel. And I wondered what you think the novel can do now in the 21st century and what, if anything, keeps it vital as an art form.
Yes, and as you say, it's exactly right. It's the kind of oft foretold. I think basically as soon as the novel was invented, everybody started prophesying its imminent doom. So it's always had this sense around it of being this quite fragile form. And I think that's because of the fragility of individual, you know, the novel is an incredibly subjective, incredibly individualistic entity when it is that sort of authentic expression of a mortal vantage point. So it in a way has no reason to be unless some other human, like a reader, finds it worthy. There's that sort of weird absolute codependence of the writer on the reader in that respect. If no one cares, then the novel is just a bundle of pages or something online. So that there's that sense, that necessary communion, I think is really important. In terms of why it matters, I think we're in this fascinating moment again where an awful lot of communication is fake, as we've heard so much about recently. And there's almost now a war of fakery, with one side accusing the other of being more fake than it is. And deliberate fakeries like the Russian Surkov Theatre of the Absurd, where you deliberately generate non-real oppositions and you try to destroy people's sense in the reality of anything they're being told. And that's incredibly cynical and really damaging. And we've seen some of the effects of it already in the rise of Trump. And so not that I'm portentously claiming that the novel's going to save us from all of that, of course. But I think, again, this sense of passionate, committed enterprises of mortals trying to relay something for other reasons, I think it's at least something that if it just means something to a reader for a three-hour period, I think that is important. And I don't care about how it's relayed. I don't care about whether it's online or whether it's in a book, a sort of, you know, a tangible book. I don't think it's that. I think it's the tenure of the enterprise that's important.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it's interesting the sort of intention behind the novel. It plays such an important part when, obviously, on one level, the novel is itself a piece of fakery. it's made
yes,
up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that sort of, there's no sort of clear cut line between, well, if it's sort of social realism and it's a real life experience, then that's good. If it's somehow fake, it's not good. I mean, some of the truest aspects of fiction come because it isn't real in the same sense that news it is, and I think that uneasy balance between fakery and reality is somewhere in there is where fiction just works.
No, that's absolutely it.
Fake news, I mean, obviously there are very real political outcomes of that are quite negative, but there's something fascinating about Surkov and the whole aspect of it and the theatricality of it, which fascinating at the same time as terrifying. Yep.
Exactly, but it's exactly what you've identified, that there's this fundamental irony of the novel, which is a very beautiful irony, that it is a completely invented, made-up thing. And yet there's a sort of possibility of communicating something quite profoundly real within it. It's a bit like, I've always really liked Stanislav Lem. And when he wrote Solaris, he said, I just thought sci-fi was not being ambitious enough because it was maintaining a commitment to some kind of realism of kind of psychology, a sort of materialist imagining of the unreal. And he said, if you're really going to do these books, these sci-fi books, you've got to imagine a consciousness that is totally, totally inexplicable to humans. a form of consciousness that goes way beyond anything that we understand. And that's what he was trying to create in Solaris. And I think there are these totally fascinating, peculiar aspects of experience that we kind of touch or hint towards in lots of enterprises that are seen to be, as you say, this funny thing with the novel, they seem to be kind of invented and made up and a bit bizarre. And then there's this sort of miasma of pseudo-truth that we're told to take really seriously. And so to me, there's a really interesting, ironic aspect to all of it all the time.
I just wanted to ask, if we go back to the idea of process and things, about what's the next project that you're working on and whereabouts in your process you are with that at the moment?
Oh, what I'm working on at the moment? So I'm writing another novel. And it's actually about some of the things I've been talking about. It's about a bit about what we all do at the moment, which is we live in this invented reality of the internet. And there's a huge problem with the internet about who is real and who's unreal. And furthermore, we're kind of, our society's generating AI consciousnesses that will now participate in this world. And it's also kind of about the levels of surveillance that are operating, and I wanted to try to do something with that. So those are the kind of ideas, and I've got several characters, and actually, as I was discussing, it's been moving around depending on who's going to be the central focal point. So that's what I'm doing at the moment, is collating the ideas and talking to people and trying to work out who will be the generative center for the whole thing if it hangs together.
And do you use this stage of the sort of research as an opportunity to go out and, I mean, you say you're sort of speaking to people. Do you go out and find experts in the field? And
yes, sort of, I do. I'm lucky because I'm on the advisory board for a festival, which I'd really recommend to your listeners, which is called How the Light Gets In, which happens every year at Hay in May. And there's one coming up next year. And that attracts, through that, actually, I've got to know a really interesting array of philosophers and scientists. And so I have talked to a lot of those people about ideas of mind and consciousness and AI, people like Peter Hacker and Roger Penrose and David Chalmers and Mary Midgley. And so there's a big community that I try to talk to about these things. And then, yes, I mean, I'm involved with things like The New Scientist. And we had a great debate, for example, on transhumanism at the Barbican earlier this year, which again is a fascinating kind of almost sci-fi in itself notion. You know, why would you want to become immortal? Why are all the people who want to become immortal really rich white men? You know, what is going on with this impetus towards general immortality and so on? Or not general, elite immortality rather. And so, you know, that's another question. And also, what are you saving if you upload consciousness? What have you actually preserved? What is this thing that you're hoping to render digital? So those questions, I do try to talk to people who know a ton more about them than I do.
It's a panel at the festival here.
Yes.
I think there's so many interesting ideas that are emerging at the moment.
Absolutely, there are, and a lot of them are already voiced in sci-fi. You know, like Philip K. Dick, you know, foresaw so much. There's so many of these questions about, are you an authentic human? Are you a replicant? How do you know? I mean, all of that is now even more present in the contemporary debate. And then we have questions of individual freedom and privacy and the sort of Orwellian scape, but in a very technocratic society. And we've got so much that is emerging. And I think it's a very interesting. I think we're in a sort of interim zone, but I think also people always feel they're in an interim zone. So that's partly just the experience of being human in a society.
Mm. I think it's important that so many of these conversations seem to take place naturally enough, I suppose, from a technological point of view, as you said, the sort of empirical rationalist sort of viewpoint that's maybe not always aligned with the idea of writing fiction. And I mean, a lot of the technologies are developed by people that obviously need to look at the world through that lens to create the technology. But how that is then viewed through other lenses, I think, is an interesting discussion that maybe doesn't happen quite as often as it could.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting about the level of language that, say, you create a map of the brain or of, you know, the mind as intimately connected to the brain. And you say that there's an area of emotional intelligence. I've heard neuroscientists say things like this. This is where emotional intelligence is in the brain. That there's a notion, in a sense, that that term is a sort of integer, that it has a finite meaning. And of course, get any novelist or poet into the scene and they'll say, what is intelligence? What is emotion? And I think that's quite productive, that clash of response to language, a very fraught response that you have within poetry, you know, any form of kind of creative writing, and that more, that notion that there are these finite elements that words might refer to. I mean, Wittgenstein is obviously a critical figure in all these debates, and I think neuroscience could do with a healthy dose of Wittgenstein.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a really interesting comparison that could be made in this space to our visual system and the way that languages of science and literature can combine something more than either on its own. If you think of the left and right eye, for example, they can each give a description of the visual field that can be thought of as complete. Each eye is capable of seeing any object in front of it and describing it. But it's only through the combination that this sort of strange new feature of depth perception emerges.
Yeah.
I think depth perception's a good example of something that it doesn't reside in either the right eye or the left eye, but only appears through the combination or comparison or translation of two different perspectives. And I think it can be argued that there's maybe something similar happening with the combination of perspectives that you might get between a quantitative, mathematical, sort of scientific approach to reality, and more Wittgensteinian literary view of the world.
Absolutely. And perception, I mean, I tried to write a bit about perception in my last novel. It's one of those enormous, still not entirely resolved mysteries. And again, a lot of the expression of it, Peter Hacker, this Oxford philosopher, is amazing on this, that a lot of the time when people talk about these things, that there's a notion of a sort of accidentally, almost, the language used creates this notion of a little homunculus in the brain, because people start saying, you know, and the brain decides to do this, or the thing in the brain decides it wants to do this. And so there's a huge question about what realities language generates. You know, when you use these words, there's a further sort of recess of meaning. And he's amazing on that, of just taking all these terms and saying, well, if you say this, do you really mean there's a, you know, little person kind of thinking and feeling all these things and making the body move? So I think, yes, this is all something that's skewed notions of language and questioning notions of language are quite useful for, I think.
I think also related to the themes that you're talking about for your next work, I was thinking it's quite interesting, having asked you about what's vital about fiction now, and the idea that we didn't really publicly have a conversation about what we are all agreeing to on the internet and the extent to which our data is held and the relationships we have. That just sort of evolved. And and maybe fiction is a good place for us to start saying, well, these are some of the things that we haven't talked about, and the we might be trying to close the barn door after the horse has bolted on something.
Absolutely, that's absolutely true. And that was the reason for Snowden's actions. What he did, this incredibly risky thing that he did, was to try to generate a public debate. Then, of course, our government then passed the Investigatory Powers Bill, which effectively legalized a lot of what was being done illegally, still without any public debate, despite Snowden. So the situation, I think, is very grave in that respect, as you mentioned. And absolutely, if writers can't have a debate about it, when so much of it actually is happening at the level of language, there's obviously huge torrents of imagery on the internet, but a lot of the ways in which people are being assessed and intruded upon is actually at the level of the words they're using, and words that trigger certain sorts of attention and focus. And so I think writers, it's incredibly important that we have some response to it. Not that I'm saying people must have a response to it, but I think, you know, for myself as a writer, it's really crucial. And I think also there's a funny notion within art, and it's a Flaubertian 19th century notion, that the greatest artist is the most objective, and you don't know their vantage point, and they're indifferent, paring their fingernails, the sort of Joycean, you know, after Flaubert sort of announcement. And while that is a really beautiful tradition, and I admire vast realms of the authors who work in it, there's also another tradition, which is the Orwellian tradition, where he said, of course, all art is political because all art has a vantage point. And there's always an impetus within the work which is related to the vantage point of the author, and that is a political aspect. And so I think, you know, I don't think writers need to shy away from these debates at all.
Thank you to Joanna for joining us, and thank you for listening to episode 10 of Unsigned Methods.
Has any of your research for novel writing ever involved considering whether or not you'd have to shoot a polar bear?
Not yet.
Now we know what to do. If your research ever takes you there, have a friend with a gun.
Booking a ticket to Svalbard. You can find me online at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
And for what my website is currently worth, you can find me at jamiebatchin.com or follow me on Twitter at jamiebatchin. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.